Travis. You've kept quiet for 9 years while he's been accused and persecuted. You've wasted yesterday and today, and if you keep flip-flopping, the time will run out and he'll be dead. I can't stop it. You can try. You can go to Sloan and tell the authorities where the body is buried. You can admit the truth, show them the ring, make plenty of noise. I'm sure the reporters and cameras would love you. Who knows, maybe a judge or the governor will take notice. I don't have a lot of experience in these matters, Travis, but it seems to me that they might find it difficult to execute Dante Drum when you're on television claiming you killed Nicole and you acted alone. I don't have a car. Rent one. I haven't had a driver's license in 10 years. Take a bus. I don't have the money for a bus ticket, Pastor. I'll loan you the money. No, I'll give you the money for a one-way bus ticket to Sloan. What if I have a seizure on the bus or black out? Hell, they might kick me off in Podunk, Oklahoma. You're playing games, Travis. You gotta take me, Reverend. Just me and you. If you'll drive me down there, I'll tell the truth about what really happened. I'll take them to the body. We can stop the execution, but you gotta go with me. Why me? Ain't nobody else around right now, Pastor. I have a better idea. Tomorrow morning, let's go downtown to the prosecutor's office. I have a friend there. You tell him the story. Maybe we can convince him to call the prosecutor in Sloan, as well as the police chief and defense lawyer and, I don't know, maybe even a judge somewhere. They'll listen to him a lot quicker than they'll listen to a Lutheran minister who knows nothing about the criminal justice system. We can video your statement, send it immediately to the authorities in Texas, send it to the newspapers, too. How about it, Travis? You won't violate parole. I won't get in trouble by helping you. Dana was nodding her approval. 5 seconds. 10 seconds. Finally, Travis said, Maybe it'll work, Pastor. Maybe we can stop the execution, but there's no way they're finding her. I have to be there for that. Let's concentrate on stopping it. They're discharging me tomorrow morning at 9. I'll be there, Travis. The prosecutor's office is not far away. 5 seconds. 10 seconds. I like it, Pastor. Let's do it. At 1 a.m., Dana found the bottle of over-the-counter sleeping aids, but an hour later they were still awake. The trip to Texas occupied them. They had discussed it briefly once before, but were so afraid of it they had not pursued the conversation. The idea was ludicrous. Keith, in Sloan, with a serial sex offender of dubious credibility, trying to get someone to listen to a bizarre tale while the town counted down the final hours of Dante Drum. The unlikely pair would be ridiculed, maybe even shot. And upon his return to Kansas, the Reverend Keith Schroeder could find himself accused of a crime for which there would be no defense. His job and career could hang in the balance. All because of a lowlife like Travis Boyette. Chapter 12. Wednesday morning. 6 hours after leaving his office, just after midnight, Robbie was back in the conference room preparing for another frantic day. The night had not gone well. The drinking session with Fred Pryor and Joey Gamble produced nothing, except an admission by Gamble that Mr. Coffey had indeed called and reminded him of the penalties for perjury. Robbie had listened to the entire session. Pryor, who over the years had become masterful with his recording devices, had used the same pen mic and passed along their conversation through a cell phone. The sound quality was remarkable. Robbie had enjoyed a few drinks along with them, in his office, with Martha Handler sipping bourbon and Carlos, the paralegal, drinking beer and monitoring the speakerphone. They all had enjoyed their booze for almost 2 hours, Joey and Fred in a fake saloon somewhere outside of Houston, and the Flack Law Firm hard at work at the office in the old train station. After 2 hours, though, Joey had had enough, even beers, and said he was tired of being pressured. He could not accept the reality that a last-minute affidavit signed by him would repudiate his testimony at trial. He did not want to call himself a liar, though he stopped short of admitting he'd lied. "Dante should not have confessed," he said several times, as if uttering a false confession were grounds enough for a death sentence. But Pryor would shadow him throughout Wednesday and Thursday if necessary. He believed there was still a slight chance, one that increased as the hours went by. At 7 a.m., the firm gathered in the conference room for the daily briefing. All were present, all bleary-eyed and fatigued and ready for the final push. Dr. Christy Hines had worked through the night and finished her report. She summarized it briefly while everyone ate pastries and gulped coffee. The report was 45 pages long, more than the court would want to read, but maybe enough to get someone's attention. Her findings surprised no one, at least no one with the Flack Law Firm. She described her examination of Dante Drum. She had reviewed his medical and psychological history while in prison. She had read 260 letters he had written over the 8 years he'd been on death row. He was schizophrenic, psychotic, delusional, and depressed, and did not understand what was happening to him. She went on to condemn solitary confinement as a means of incarceration, and again labeled it as a cruel form of torture. Robbie instructed Sammy Thomas to file their petition for relief to the firm's co-counsel in Austin. Throughout the appellate process, all 8 years of it, Robbie's firm had been assisted by the Texas Capital Defender Group, commonly referred to as the Defender Group, a nonprofit that represented about 25% of the inmates on death row. The Defender Group did nothing but capital appeals, and did so with great expertise and diligence. Sammy would send the petition and report electronically, and at 9 a.m. the Defender Group would file hard copies with the Court of Criminal Appeals. With an execution looming, the court was on alert and prepared to quickly address the last-minute filings. If they were denied, which they usually were, Robbie and the Defender Group could then run to federal court and fight their way up the mountain, hoping for a miracle at some point. He discussed these strategies and made certain everyone knew what was to be done. Carlos would be in charge of the Drum family the following day, though he would remain in Sloan. He was to make sure they arrived at Polunsky on time for their final visit. Robbie would be there to make the final walk with his client and to witness the execution. Sammy Thomas and the other associate would remain at the office and coordinate the filings with the Defender Group. Bonnie, the paralegal, would stay in touch with the offices of the governor and the attorney general. The request for a reprieve had been filed with the governor's office, and its denial was being awaited. The Christy Hines petition was ready to go. Unless and until Joey Gamble had a change of heart, there was no new evidence to make a fuss about. As the meeting dragged on, it became evident that there was little of substance left to do. Conversation waned. The frenzy was beginning to subside. Everyone was suddenly tired. The waiting had begun. When Vivian Grail was elected to the bench in 1994, her campaign had been about high moral standards, putting the laws of God first, putting criminals in prison for even longer periods of time, and, of course, more efficient use of the death chamber down at Huntsville. She won by 30 votes. She defeated a wise and experienced judge by the name of Elias Henry, and she did so by cherry-picking several criminal cases in which Judge Henry had dared to show compassion for the accused. She splashed these around in ads that made him look like a coddler of pedophiles. After her affair with Paul Coffey was exposed, after her divorce, and after she resigned and left Sloan in disgrace, the voters repented and returned to Judge Henry. He was reelected without opposition. He was now 81 years old and in declining health. There were rumors that he might not be able to finish his term. Judge Henry had been a close friend of Robbie's father, who died in 2001. Because of this friendship, he was one of the few judges in East Texas whose blood pressure did not spike when Robbie Flack walked into the courtroom. Elias Henry was about the only judge Robbie trusted. At Judge Henry's invitation, Robbie agreed to meet in his chambers at 9 a.m. Wednesday morning. The purpose of the meeting was not discussed on the phone. "This case bothers me a great deal," Judge Henry said after a few pleasantries were out of the way. They were alone, in an old office that had changed little in the 40 years Robbie had visited it. The courtroom was next door, and empty. As well it should. They both had unopened bottles of water in front of them on a work table. The judge, as always, wore a dark suit with an orange tie. He was having a good day, his eyes fierce and intense. There were no smiles.
"I've read the transcript, Robbie," he said. "I started last week and I've read it all, and most of the appellate briefs as well. Taking a view from the bench, I can't believe Judge Grail allowed that confession into evidence. It was coerced and blatantly unconstitutional."
"It was, Judge, and it is. I won't defend her, but she had little choice. There's no other credible evidence. If she tossed a confession, then Coffey had nowhere to go. No conviction, no defendant, no suspect, no dead body. Dante would have walked out of jail, which would have been front-page news. As you well know, Judge Grail had to face the voters, and judges don't get reelected in East Texas if they keep the law above politics."
"Tell me about it."
"Once he knew the confession would go to the jury, Coffey was able to piece together other evidence. He stomped and strutted and convinced the jury that Dante was the killer. He pointed fingers at him, and then he cried at the very mention of Nicole's name. Quite a performance. What's the old saying, Judge? If you don't have the facts, yell. And he did a lot of yelling. The jury was more than willing to believe him. He won."
"You fought like hell, Robbie. Should have fought harder. And you're convinced he's innocent? No doubt in your mind?"
"Why are we having this discussion, Judge? It seems rather moot at this point."
"Because I'm going to call the governor and ask for a reprieve. Maybe he'll listen. I don't know. I wasn't the trial judge. I was, as we know, retired at the time. But I have a cousin in Texarkana who gave the governor a ton of money. It's a long shot, but what's there to lose? What's wrong with delaying things another 30 days?
"Nothing. You're having doubts about his guilt, Judge?"
"Serious doubts. I would not have admitted the confession. I would have thrown the snitch in jail for lying. I would have excluded that clown with his bloodhounds. And the boy, what's his name?"
"Joey Gamble."
"Right, the white boyfriend. His testimony would probably go to the jury, but it was too inconsistent to carry weight. You said it best in one of your briefs, Robbie. This conviction is based on a bogus confession, a dog named Yogi, a lying snitch who later recanted, and a jilted lover bent on revenge. We can't convict people with garbage such as this. Judge Grail was biased. I guess we know why. Paul Coffey was blinded by his own tunnel vision and the fear he might be wrong. It's a terrible case, Robbie. Thank you, Judge. I've lived it for 9 years. And it's dangerous. I met with 2 black lawyers yesterday. Good guys. You know them. They're angry with the system, but they're also afraid of the backlash. They expect trouble if Drum is executed.
That's what I hear.
What can be done, Robbie? Is there a way to stop this? I'm not a death penalty lawyer, and I don't know where your appeals are right now.
Tank is almost empty, Judge. We're filing an insanity petition now.
And your chances?
Slim. Dante has no record of mental illness until now. We're alleging that 8 years on death row have driven him insane. As you know, the appeals courts usually frown on theories that are hatched at the last minute.
Is the boy crazy?
He has severe problems, but I suspect he knows what's happening.
So you're not optimistic?
I'm a criminal defense lawyer, Judge. Optimism is not in my DNA. Judge Henry finally unscrewed the cap off the plastic bottle of water and took a sip. His eyes never left Robbie.
Very well. I'll call the governor, he said, as if his phone call would save the day. It would not. The governor was getting lots of calls right now. Robbie and his team were generating plenty. Thanks, Judge, but don't expect much. This governor has never stopped an execution. In fact, he wants to speed them up. He has his eye on a Senate seat, and he counts votes before he chooses what to eat for breakfast. He's a two-faced, cutthroat, dirt-dumb, chicken-shit, slimy little bastard with a bright future in politics.
So you didn't vote for him?
I did not. But please, give him a call.
I will. I'm meeting with Paul Coffey in half an hour to discuss this with him. I don't want him to be surprised. I'll also chat with the fellow over at the newspaper. I want to be on record in opposition to this execution.
Thanks, Judge, but why now? We could have had this conversation a year ago, or five. It's awfully late to get involved.
A year ago, few people were thinking about Dante Drum. There was no execution looming. There was a chance he would find relief in a federal court. Maybe a reversal, a new trial. I don't know, Robbie. Maybe I should have been more involved, but this is not my case. I was busy with my own matters.
I understand, Judge. They shook hands and offered their farewells. Robbie took the back stairs so he wouldn't bump into some lawyer or clerk who wanted to chat. As he hurried along the empty corridor, he tried to think of another elected official in Sloan or in Chester County who had voiced support for Dante Drum. One came to mind, the only black city councilman in Sloan. For 9 years, he had fought a long and lonely battle, and he was about to lose. A phone call from the cousin of a big donor would never be enough to stop an execution in Texas. The machinery was well-oiled and efficient. It was in motion, and there was no way to stop it. On the front lawn of the courthouse, city workers were assembling a makeshift podium. A few policemen loitered about, chatting nervously as they watched the first church bus unload. A dozen or so black folks got off and made their way across the lawn and past the war memorials. They found their spot, unfolded chairs, and began to wait. The rally or protest or whatever it was to be called was scheduled for noon. Robbie had been asked to speak but declined. He couldn't think of anything to say that would not be inflammatory, and he did not want to be accused of inciting the crowd. There would be enough troublemakers. According to Carlos, who was charged with monitoring the website, the comments, and the blogs, the traffic was increasing dramatically. Protests were being planned for Thursday in Austin, Huntsville, and Sloan, and on the campuses of at least two of the black universities in Texas. Give 'em hell, Robbie thought, as he drove away. Chapter 13. Keith arrived early at the hospital and made his rounds. St. Mark's Lutheran currently had half a dozen members in various stages of treatment or recuperation. He said hello to all six, shared a quick word of comfort, held their hands in prayer, then was off to get Mr. Boyette for what promised to be an eventful day. Eventful in unexpected ways. Mr. Boyette was already gone. According to a nurse, when they checked on him at 6 a.m., they found his bed empty and neatly made up, his hospital gown folded next to his pillow, and the IV wrapped carefully around the portable stand next to his bed. An hour later, someone from Anchor House called with the message that Travis Boyette was back home and wanted his doctor to know all was well. Keith drove to Anchor House, but Boyette was not there. According to a supervisor, he was not scheduled to work on Wednesdays. No one had any idea where he was or when he might return. As Keith was driving to St. Mark's, he told himself not to worry, not to panic. Boyette would show. Then he called himself an idiot for placing even the remotest bit of confidence in a confessed murderer, a serial rapist, and a compulsive liar. Because he habitually tried to see the good in every person he knew and met, he realized, as he began to panic,
that he had been much too gentle with Boyette. He had tried too hard to be understanding, even compassionate. Hell, the man had murdered a 17-year-old girl just to satisfy his lust, and was now seemingly content to watch another man die for the crime. God only knew how many other women he'd raped. Keith was angry when he entered the church office. Charlotte Younger, back from the flu, greeted him with a cheery, "Good morning, Pastor," and Keith was barely civil. "I'm locked in my office, okay? No calls unless it's a man named Travis Boyette." "Yes, sir." He closed his door, ripped off his coat, and called Dana with the latest news. "He's loose on the streets?" she asked. "Well, yes, he's in the process of getting paroled. He's served his time and he's about to be a free man. I guess you could say he's loose." "Thank God for the tumor. I can't believe you said that." "Sorry, I can't either." "What's the plan?" "There's nothing to do but wait. Maybe he'll show up." "Keep me posted." Keith called Matthew Burns in the prosecutor's office and told him there was a delay. Matthew had first been cool to the idea of meeting Boyette and videoing his statement, but he came around. He had agreed to make a call or two to Texas after he heard Boyette's story, if, in fact, he believed what he heard. He was disappointed to hear the man was missing. Keith checked the Drum website for an update, something he'd done almost every waking hour since Monday morning. He went to the filing cabinets and pulled out folders with old sermons. He called Dana again, but she was having coffee with the girls. At exactly 10:30 a.m., he called the law office of Robbie Flack. The young lady who answered the phone explained that Mr. Flack was unavailable. Keith said he understood this and said that he'd called yesterday, Tuesday, left his phone numbers but had not heard from anyone. "I have information about the murder of Nicole Yarber," he said. "What type of information?" she asked. "I need to speak to Mr. Flack," Keith said firmly. "I will give him the message," she said, just as firmly. "Please, I'm not some wacko. This is very important." "Yes, sir, thank you." He decided to violate the vow of confidentiality. There were two possible consequences. First, Boyette could sue him for damages, but Keith was no longer worried about this. The brain tumor would take care of any future litigation. And if, for some reason, Boyette survived, he would be required to prove that Keith's breach of confidence had caused him damages. Though Keith knew little about the law, he found it difficult to believe that a judge or jury anywhere would have sympathy for such a miserable person. The second consequence was that of a possible disciplinary action by the church. But in light of the facts, and especially in light of the liberal leanings of the synod, he could not imagine anything more than a slap on the wrist. "Screw it," he said to himself. "I'm talking." He typed an email for Robbie Flack. He described himself, leaving all possible phone numbers and addresses along the way. He described his encounter with an unnamed parolee who once lived in Sloan, and did so at the time Nicole disappeared. This parolee has a lengthy criminal record, a violent one, and was once arrested and jailed in Sloan. Keith had verified this. The man confessed to the rape and murder of Nicole Yarber and gave plenty of details. Her body was buried deep in the hills south of Joplin, Missouri, where this parolee grew up. The only person who can find the body is the parolee himself. Please call. Keith Schroeder. An hour later, Keith left his office and drove back to Anchor House. No one had seen Boyette. He drove downtown and had another quick lunch with Matthew Burns. After some debate and a bit of cajoling, Matthew pulled out his cell phone and called Flack's office. Keith heard him say, "Yes, hello. My name is Matthew Burns, and I am a prosecutor in Topeka, Kansas. I would like to speak to Mr. Robbie Flack." Mr. Flack was unavailable. "I have some information about the Dante Drum case, specifically the identity of the real killer." Mr. Flack was still unavailable. Matthew then gave his phone numbers, cell and office, and invited the receptionist to visit the website for the City of Topeka, Office of the City Attorney, to verify his legitimacy. She said she would do this. "I'm not some nut, okay? Please, Have Mr. Flack call me as soon as possible. Thank you. They finished lunch and agreed to alert each other if a call came from Texas. Driving back to the office, Keith was relieved to have a friend, an attorney at that, willing to lend a hand. By noon, the streets of downtown Sloan had been blocked and barricaded, and routine traffic had been diverted elsewhere. Dozens of church buses and vans were double-parked around the courthouse, but the police were not writing tickets. Their orders were to maintain a presence, keep the peace, and by all means, do nothing to provoke anyone. Emotions were high. The situation was tense. Most of the merchants closed their shops, and most of the white folks disappeared. The crowd, all black, continued to grow. Hundreds of students from Sloan High School skipped out and arrived in packs, already rowdy and anxious to be heard. Factory workers brought their lunchboxes and ate while they milled around the courthouse lawn. Reporters took photos and scribbled notes. Camera crews from Sloan and Tyler bunched together near the podium on the front steps of the courthouse. At 12:15 p.m., Mr. Oscar Betts, president of the local NAACP chapter, stepped to the microphones, thanked everyone for coming, and quickly got down to business. He proclaimed the innocence of Dante Drum and said his execution was nothing more than a legal lynching. He blistered the police in a scathing condemnation, calling them racist and determined to kill an innocent man. He ridiculed a judicial system that would allow an all-white jury to pass judgment on an innocent black man. Unable to resist, he asked the crowd, "How are you supposed to get a fair trial when the prosecutor's sleeping with the judge? And the appeals court said it was okay? Only in Texas." He described the death penalty as a disgrace, an outdated tool of revenge that does not deter crime, is not used fairly, and has been abandoned by all civilized countries. Almost every sentence was followed with applause and shouting as the crowd grew louder. He called on the court system to stop the madness. He mocked the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. He called the governor a coward for not stopping the execution. He warned of unrest in Sloan and East Texas, and perhaps even the entire nation, if the state went forward with the execution of an innocent black man. Betts did a masterful job of raising emotions and tensions. When he finally wound down, he changed course and asked the crowd to behave, to stay off the streets tonight and tomorrow night. "We gain nothing by violence," he pleaded. When he finished, he introduced the Reverend Johnny Canty, pastor of the Bethel African Methodist Church, where the Drum family had worshipped for over 20 years. Reverend Canty began with a message from the family. They were thankful for the support. They remained strong in their faith and were praying for a miracle. Roberta Drum was doing as well as could be expected. Her plans were to travel to death row tomorrow and be there until the end. Reverend Canty then asked for quiet and began a long, eloquent prayer that started with a plea for compassion for the family of Nicole Yarber, a family that had endured the nightmare of the death of an innocent child. Just like the Drum family, he thanked the Almighty for the gift of life and the promise of eternity for all people. He thanked God for His laws, the most basic and most important being the Ten Commandments, which included the prohibition, "Thou shalt not kill." He prayed for those other Christians out there who take the same Bible and twist it and use it as a weapon to kill others.
"Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do."
Canty had worked on his prayer for a long time, and he delivered it slowly, with perfect timing and without notes. The crowd hummed and swayed and offered hearty amens as he plodded along, no end in sight. It was far more a speech than a prayer, and Canty savored the moment. After praying for justice, he prayed for peace. Not the peace that avoids violence, but the peace yet to be found in a society in which young black men are incarcerated in record numbers, in which they are executed far more often than those of other races, in which crimes committed by blacks are deemed more grievous than the same crimes committed by whites, He prayed for mercy, for forgiveness, for strength. Like most ministers, Canty went on too long and was losing his audience when he suddenly found it again. He began praying for Dante, our persecuted brother, a young man snatched from his family 9 years ago and thrown into a hellhole from which no man escaped alive. 9 years without his family and friends. 9 years locked away like a caged animal. 9 years serving the time for a crime committed by someone else. From the window of a small law library on the third floor, Judge Elias Henry watched and listened. The crowd was under control as the Reverend prayed, yet it was the restlessness that frightened the judge. Sloan had known little racial discord over the decades, and the judge took most of the credit for this, but only when talking to himself. 50 years earlier, when he'd been a young lawyer struggling to pay his bills, he'd taken a part-time job reporting and writing editorials for the Sloan Daily News, then a prosperous weekly that was read by all. Now it was a struggling daily with a lower readership. In the early 1960s, the newspaper was one of the few in East Texas that recognized the fact that a sizable portion of the population was black. Elias Henry wrote occasional stories about black sports teams and black history, and though this was not well received, it was not openly condemned. His editorials, though, managed to rile up the whites. He explained in layman's terms the true meaning of Brown versus Board of Education and criticized the segregated schools in Sloan and Chester County. The newspaper, through the growing influence of Elias and the declining health of its owner, took bold stands in favor of voting rights for blacks, as well as fair pay and fair housing. His arguments were persuasive, his reasoning was sound, and most of those who read his opinions realized he was far smarter than they were. He bought the paper in 1966 and owned it for 10 years. He also became a skilled lawyer and politician and a leader in the community. A lot of white folks disagreed with Elias, but few challenged him publicly. When the schools were finally desegregated at the end of a federal gun barrel, white resistance in Sloan had been softened after years of crafty manipulation by Elias Henry. After he was elected judge, he sold the paper and assumed a loftier position. From there, he quietly but firmly controlled a judicial system that was known to be tough on those who were violent, strict on those who needed guidance, and compassionate to those who needed another chance. His defeat by Vivian Grail led to a nervous breakdown. The conviction of Dante Drum would not have happened on his watch. He would have known about the arrest not long after it occurred. He would have examined the confession and the circumstances surrounding it, and he would have called in Paul Coffey for an unofficial meeting, just the two of them with the door locked, to inform the DA that his case was rotten. The confession was hopelessly unconstitutional. It would not get to the jury. Keep looking, Coffey, because you have yet to find your killer. Judge Henry looked at the throng packed tightly around the front of the courthouse. Not a white face anywhere except for the reporters. It was an angry black crowd. The whites were hiding and not sympathetic. His town was split, something he thought he would never see. "God help us," he mumbled to himself. The next speaker was Palomar Reed, a senior at the high school and vice president of the student body. He began with the obligatory condemnation of the death sentence and launched into a windy and technical diatribe against capital punishment, with heavy emphasis on the Texas version of it. The crowd stayed with him, though he lacked the drama of the more experienced speakers. Palomar, though, soon proved to have an incredible knack for the dramatic. Looking at a sheet of paper, he began calling the names of the black players on the Sloan High School football team. One by one, they hurried to the podium and formed a line along the top step. Each wore the royal blue home jersey of the Sloan Warriors. When all 28 were packed shoulder to shoulder, Palomar made a shocking announcement. "These players stand here united with their brother Dante Drum, a Sloan Warrior, an African Warrior.
If the people of this city, county, and state succeed in their illegal and unconstitutional efforts to kill Dante Drum tomorrow night, these warriors will not play in Friday's game against Longview. The crowd exhaled in one massive cheer that rattled the windows of the courthouse. Palomar looked at the players, and on cue, all 28 reached for their shirt tails and quickly yanked off the jerseys. They threw them at their feet. Under the jerseys, each player wore an identical white t-shirt with the unmistakable image of Dante's face. Under it, in bold lettering, was the word innocent. The players puffed their chests and pumped their fists, and the crowd drowned them in adoration. "We will boycott classes tomorrow," Palomar yelled into the microphone. "And Friday, too. And there will be no football game on Friday night." The rally was being broadcast live on the local channel, and most of the white folks in Sloan were glued to their televisions. In banks, in schools, in homes, in offices, the same muted utterances were heard. "They can't do that, can they?" "Of course they can. How do you stop them?" "They've gone too far." "No, we've gone too far." "So you think he's innocent?" "I'm not sure. No one's sure. That's the problem. There's just too much doubt." "He confessed." "They never found the body." "Why can't they just stop things for a few days, you know, a reprieve or something like that?" "Why?" "Wait till after football season." "I'd prefer not to have a riot." "If they riot, then they'll be prosecuted." "Don't bet on it. This place is going to explode." "Kick them off the team." "Who do they think they are calling the game off?" "We got 40 white boys who can play." "Damn right we do. Coach ought to kick them off the team. And they ought to arrest them if they skip school." "Brilliant. That'll throw gas on the fire." At the high school, the football coach watched the protest in the principal's office. The coach was white, the principal black. They stared at the television and said nothing. At the police department, three blocks down Main Street from the courthouse, Chief of Police Joe Radford watched the television with his assistant chief. The department had 4 dozen uniformed officers on the payroll, and at that moment, 30 were watching nervously from the fringes of the rally.
"Will the execution take place?" the assistant chief asked. "Far as I know," Radford answered. "I talked to Paul Coffey an hour ago, and he thinks it's a go."
"We might need some help."
"No. They'll throw a few rocks, but it'll blow over."
Paul Coffey watched the show alone at his desk with a sandwich and chips. His office was 2 blocks behind the courthouse, and he could hear the crowd when it roared. For him, such demonstrations were necessary evils in a country that valued the Bill of Rights. Folks could gather lawfully, with permission, of course, and express their feelings. The same laws that protected this right also governed the orderly flow of justice. His job was to prosecute criminals and put the guilty ones away. And when a crime was grave enough, the laws of his state directed him to extract revenge and seek the death penalty. This he had done in the Drum case. He had no regrets, no doubts, not the slightest uneasiness about his decisions, his tactics at trial, or the guilt of Drum. His work had been ratified by seasoned appellate judges on numerous occasions. Dozens of these learned jurists had reviewed every word of the Drum trial and affirmed his conviction. Coffey was at peace with himself. He regretted his involvement with Judge Vivian Grail and the pain and embarrassment it had caused. But he had never doubted that her rulings were right. He missed her. Their romance had cracked under the strain of all the negative attention it created. She ran away and refused any contact. His career as a prosecutor would soon be over, and he hated to admit that he would leave office under a cloud. The Drum execution, though, would be his high watermark, his vindication, a shining moment that the people of Sloan, or at least the white ones, would appreciate.
Tomorrow would be his finest day. The Flack law firm watched the rally on the widescreen television in the main conference room. And when it was finally over, Robbie retreated to his office with half a sandwich and a Diet Cola. The receptionist had carefully arranged a dozen phone message slips on the center of his desk. The ones from Topeka caught his attention. Something rang a bell. Ignoring the food, he picked up the phone and punched in the number for a cell phone of the Reverend Keith Schroeder. "Keith Schroeder, please," he said when someone answered, "Hello." "Speaking. This is Robbie Flack, attorney in Sloan, Texas. I have your message, and I think I saw an email a few hours ago." "Yes, thank you, Mr. Flack. It's Robbie." "Okay, Robbie. It's Keith on this end." "Fine, Keith. Where's the body?" "In Missouri." "I have no time to waste, Keith, and something tells me this call is a complete waste of time." "Maybe it is, but give me 5 minutes. Talk fast." Keith ran through the facts. His encounters with an unnamed parolee, his search into his background, the man's criminal record, his dire medical condition, everything he could cram into 5 uninterrupted minutes. "Obviously you're not worried about breaching confidentiality here," Robbie said. "I'm troubled by it, but the stakes are too high, and I haven't told you his name." "Where is he now?" "He spent last night in a hospital. Checked himself out this morning, and I haven't heard from him since. He's due back at the halfway house at 6 p.m. sharp. I'll be there to see him." "And he has 4 felony convictions for sex offenses?" "At least." "Pastor, this man has 0 credibility. I can't do anything with this. There's nothing here. You gotta understand, Keith, that these executions always attract the nutcases. We had 2 fruitcakes show up last week. One claimed to know where Nicole is living now. She's a stripper, by the way. And the other claimed to have killed her in a satanic ritual. Location of the body unknown. The first wanted some money. The second wanted out of prison in Arizona. The courts despise these last-minute fantasies. He says the body is buried in the hills south of Joplin, Missouri. That's where he grew up. How soon can he find the body?" "I can't answer that." "Come on, Keith. Give me something I can use." "He has her class ring. I've seen it, held it, and examined it. SHS 1999 with her initials, ANY. Blue stone, size about 6. "This is good, Keith. I like it. But where is the ring right now?" "I assume it's around his neck." "And you don't know where he is?" Correct. At this moment, I don't know where he is." "Who is Matthew Burns?" "A friend of mine, a prosecutor." "Look, Keith, I appreciate your concern. You've called twice, emailed once, got one of your friends to call. Thank you very much. I'm a very busy man right now, so please leave me alone." Robbie picked up his sandwich as he put down the phone. Chapter 14. Gil Newton had been the governor of Texas for 5 years, and though polls showed an enviable level of approval among the electorate, the polls were dwarfed by his own estimation of his popularity. He was from Laredo, far down in South Texas, where he'd been raised on a ranch that had been owned by his grandfather, who'd once been a sheriff. Gil had scratched his way through college and law school, and when no firm would hire him, he became an assistant prosecutor in El Paso. At the age of 29, he was elected district attorney in the first of many successful campaigns. He had never lost one. By the age of 40, he'd sent 5 men to death row. As governor, he'd watched 2 of them die, explaining that it was his duty since he'd prosecuted them. Though records were sketchy, it was widely believed that Newton was the only sitting governor of Texas to witness an execution. This was certainly true for the modern era. In interviews, he claimed that watching the men die had given him a sense of closure. "I remember the victims," he said. "I kept thinking about the victims. These were horrible crimes." Newton seldom passed on a chance to be interviewed. Brash, loud, vulgar, and private, he was wildly popular because of his anti-government rhetoric, his unwavering beliefs, his outrageous comments that he never apologized for, and his love of Texas and its history of fierce independence. The vast majority of voters also shared his fondness for the death penalty. With his second and final term secured, Newton was already gazing across the borders of Texas and contemplating a larger stage, something bigger. He was needed. Late Wednesday afternoon, he met with his two closest advisors, two old friends from law school who had helped with every major decision and most of the minor ones as well. Wayne Walcott was the lawyer, or chief counsel, as his letterhead proclaimed, and Barry Ringfield was the mouthpiece, or director of communications. On a routine day in Austin, the three met in the governor's office at precisely 5:15 p.m. They took off their coats, dismissed the secretaries, locked the door, and at 5:30 p.m. poured the bourbon. Then they got down to business. "This Drum thing could get messy tomorrow," Barry was saying. "Blacks are pissed, and they got demonstrations scheduled all over the state tomorrow." "Where?" the governor asked. "Well, here for starters. On the south lawn of the Capitol, rumor has it that the Right Reverend Jeremiah Mays is flying in on his fancy jet to get the natives good and agitated." "I love it," the governor said. "The request for a reprieve has been filed and is on record," Wayne said, looking at some paperwork. He took a sip. The bourbon, Knob Creek, was poured each time into a heavy crystal Waterford glass with the state's seal on it. "Definitely more interest in this one," Barry said. "Lots of calls, letters, emails."
"Who's calling?" Newton asked.
"The usual chorus, the Pope, President of France, two members of the Dutch Parliament, Prime Minister of Kenya, Jimmy Carter, Amnesty International, that loudmouth from California who runs the Black Caucus in Washington. Lots of folks."
"Anybody important?"
"Not really. The circuit judge in Chester County, Elias Henry, has called twice and sent an email. He's in favor of a reprieve, says he has grave doubts about the jury's verdict. Most of the noise from Sloan, though, is gung-ho in favor of the execution. They think the boy's guilty. The mayor called and expressed some concerns about trouble in Sloan tomorrow night. Says he might be calling for help."
"The National Guard?" Newton asked.
"I suppose so."
"I love it."
All three took a sip. The governor looked at Barry, who was not only his mouthpiece, but also his most trusted and most devious advisor.
"You got a plan?"
Barry always had a plan.
"Sure. But it's a work in progress. I like the demonstration tomorrow, hopefully with Reverend Jeremiah stoking the fires. Big crowd, tons of Africans. A real tense situation. And you take the podium, stare down the crowd, talk about the orderly flow of justice in this state, the usual spiel. Then, right out there on the steps with cameras rolling and the crowd booing and hissing and maybe throwing rocks at you, right then and there, you deny the request for a reprieve. The crowd erupts. You make your escape. It'll take some balls, but it's priceless." "Wow," Newton said. Wayne actually laughed.
Barry continued. "3 hours later, they nuke him, but the front page will be taking on the mob of angry blacks. For the record, you got 4% of the black vote, Governor. 4%. A pause, a sip, but he wasn't finished. "I like the National Guard angle, too. Later in the afternoon, but before the execution, hold a quick press conference and announce that you're sending in the Guard to quell the uprising in Sloan.
The numbers in Chester County?
You got 71%, Gil. They love you there. You protect them by sending in the Guard."
"But is the Guard necessary?" Wayne asked. "If we overreact, then it could backfire.
It's fluid. Let's monitor the situation and decide later. Let's do that, the governor said, and the decision was made. Any chance of some court issuing a last-minute stay? Wayne tossed some papers on the governor's desk and said,
I doubt it. Drum's lawyers filed an appeal this morning claiming the boy's gone crazy and doesn't appreciate the gravity of what's coming. It's bullshit. I talked to Baker at the AG's office an hour ago, and they see nothing in the pipeline. It's all green lights.
Should be fun, the governor said. At Reva's suggestion, or insistence, the Wednesday night prayer meeting at the First Baptist Church was canceled. This had happened only 3 times in the history of the church, once for an ice storm, once for a tornado, and once for a power outage. Brother Ronnie could not bring himself to use the word canceled, so the prayer meeting was simply reclassified as a prayer vigil and was moved to another location. The weather cooperated, the sky was clear, and the temperature was almost 70 degrees. They met at sunset under a reserved pavilion at Rush Point State Park on the edge of the Red River, as close to Nicole as they could possibly get. The pavilion was on a small bluff with the river below, and about 100 yards away was the sandbar that came and went with the level of water. Her gym card and student ID had been found there. In the minds of those who loved her, this had long been the spot of Nicole's final resting place. During her many visits to Rush Point, Reva had always alerted whatever media she could arouse in Sloan. As the years passed, though, the local reporters lost interest. She often visited alone, sometimes with Wallace trailing along behind, always on her daughter's birthday and usually on December 4th, the day she disappeared. But this vigil was far different. There was something to celebrate. Fordyce, hitting hard, was represented by a 2-man crew with a small camera, the same one that had been following Reva and a weary Wallace for 2 days now. There were 2 TV news crews and 6 print reporters. The presence of so much attention inspired the worshippers, and Brother Ronnie was pleased with such a large turnout, 40 miles from home. They sang a few hymns as the sunlight faded, then lit small candles and passed them around. Reva sat in the front row and sobbed nonstop. Brother Ronnie could not resist the opportunity to preach, and his flock was in no hurry to leave. He dwelled on justice and relied on an avalanche of scripture to support God's commands for us to live as law-abiding citizens. There were prayers by deacons and testimonials from friends of Nicole's, and even Wallace, after an elbow in the ribs, managed to stand and offer a few words. Brother Ronnie finished things up with a lengthy plea for compassion and mercy and strength. He asked God to walk the final mile with Reva and Wallace and their family as they went through the ordeal of the execution. They left the pavilion and moved in a solemn procession to the makeshift shrine closer to the river's edge. They laid flowers at the foot of a white cross. Some knelt and prayed again. Everybody had a good cry. At 6 p.m. on Wednesday, Keith walked through the front door of Anchor House with every intention of corralling Travis Boyette and having a serious confrontation. The execution was exactly 24 hours away, and Keith was determined to do whatever he could to stop it. The task seemed utterly impossible, but at least he would try. An associate minister was handling the Wednesday night supper at St. Mark's. Boyette was playing games. Or maybe he was dead. During the day, he had not checked in with his parole officer and had not been seen again at Anchor House. He was required to do none of these, but the fact that he seemed to have vanished was troubling. He was, however, required to check in for the night at 6 o'clock and could not leave until 8 o'clock the following morning unless he had permission. He was not there at 6 p.m. Keith waited an hour, but there was no sign of Boyette. An ex-con named Rudy was manning the front desk. He mumbled to Keith, "You'd better go find his ass." "I wouldn't know where to start," Keith said. He left his cell phone number with Rudy and started with the hospitals. He slowly drove from one to the other, killing time, waiting for a call from Rudy, watching the streets for any sign of a 40-ish white weirdo limping along with a cane. None of the downtown hospitals had admitted a Travis boy yet. He was not loitering around the bus station, and he was not sharing a drink with the winos down by the river. At 9 p.m., Keith returned to Anchor House and sat in a chair at the front desk. "He ain't here," Rudy said. "What happens next?" Keith said. "If he comes in later tonight, they'll cuss him out but let it slide. Unless he's drunk or drugged, and then it hits the fan. They'll give you one screw-up. But if he stays out all night, they'll probably revoke him and send him back to the pen. These guys are pretty serious. What's Boyette up to?"
"It's hard to say. He has trouble with the truth."
"I heard that. I got your number. If he shows, I'll give you a call."
"Thanks."
Keith hung around for a half an hour, then drove home. Dana heated up lasagna, and they ate on TV trays in the den. The boys were already asleep. The television was on mute. They said little. Travis Boyette had consumed their lives for the better part of 3 days, and they were tired of the man. After dark, it became apparent that no one wanted to leave the train station. There was little legal work to be done, and nothing of any consequence could be thrown together at that hour to help Dante Drum. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals had not ruled on the insanity claim. Fred Pryor was still loitering on the outskirts of Houston, hoping for another drink or two with Joey Gamble, but that looked doubtful. This could well be the last night in the life of Dante Drum, and his legal team needed the comfort of each other. Carlos was sent to get pizza and beer, and when he returned, the long table in the conference room was used for dinner. When Ollie arrived later, a poker game materialized. Ollie Tufton was one of a handful of black lawyers in Sloan and a close friend of Robbie's. He was shaped like a bowling ball and claimed to weigh 400 pounds, though it was not clear why he wished to take credit for this. He was loud and hilarious and had huge appetites. Food, whiskey, poker, and, sadly, cocaine. Robbie had rescued him from near disbarment on 2 occasions. He made an occasional buck with car wrecks, but the money always disappeared. When Ollie was in the room, most of the noise came from him. He assumed control of the poker game, appointed Carlos as dealer, established the rules, and told his latest dirty jokes, all while sipping a beer and finishing off the cold pizza. The players were Martha Handler, who usually won, Bonnie, the other paralegal, Christy Hines, who was still afraid of the game and even more terrified of Ollie, and a part-time investigator runner named Ben Schutz. Schutz had a pistol in his jacket hanging on the wall. Robbie had 2 shotguns in his office, loaded. Aaron Ray was always armed, and he moved quietly around the train station, watching the windows and the parking lot. The firm had received several threatening calls during the day, and they were on full alert. Robbie took a beer to his office, left his door wide open, and called Dee Dee, his live-in partner. She was at yoga, blissfully unconcerned about the pending execution. They had been together for 3 years, and Robbie was almost convinced they had a chance. She showed almost no interest in whatever he did at the office, and this was beneficial. His journey to find true love was littered with women who could not accept the fact that life with Robbie was heavily tilted in Robbie's favor. The current girl went her own way, and they met in bed. She was 20 years younger, and Robbie was still smitten. He called a reporter in Austin but said nothing quotable. He called Judge Elias Henry and thanked him for calling the governor. They wished each other well, both knowing that the next 24 hours would be remembered for a long time. The clock on the wall seemed stuck at 9:10. Robbie would always remember that it was 9:10 p.m. when Aaron Ray walked into his office and said, "The First Baptist Church is burning." The Battle of Sloan had begun. Chapter 15. If Keith had fallen asleep, he wasn't aware of it. For the past 3 days, he had slept so little and at such odd hours that his routines and rhythms were out of sync. When the phone rang, he could have sworn he was wide awake. Dana, though, heard it first and had to nudge her husband. He finally grabbed it after the fourth or fifth ring.
"Hello?"
he said in a daze, while Dana flipped on a lamp. It was 11:40. They had gone to bed less than an hour earlier.
"Hey, Pastor. It's me, Travis," the voice said.
"Hello, Travis," Keith said, and Dana scrambled for a bathrobe. "Where are you?"
"Here, Topeka, at a diner somewhere, downtown, not far from Anchor House."
His voice was slow, his tongue thick. Keith's second or third thought was that Boyette had been drinking. "Why are you not at Anchor House?"
"It doesn't matter. Look, Pastor, I'm really hungry. Nothing since this morning, and I'm sitting here with just a cup of coffee because I don't have any money. I'm starving, Pastor. Any ideas?"
"Have you been drinking, Travis?"
"Couple of beers. I'm okay."
"You spent money on beer, but not on food."
"I didn't call to fight with you, Pastor. Can you help me get something to eat?"
"Sure, Travis, but you need to get back to Anchor House. They're waiting for you. I talked to Rudy, and he says they'll write you up, but nothing serious. Let's get something to eat, then I'll take you where you belong."
"I ain't going back there, Pastor. Forget it. I want to go to Texas, okay? I mean now. I really want to go. I'll tell everybody the truth. Tell them where the body is, everything. We gotta save that boy."
"We?
Who else, Pastor? We know the truth. If you and me get down there, we can stop this execution."
"You want me to take you to Texas right now?" Keith asked, staring into the eyes of his wife. She began shaking her head.
"There's no one else, Pastor. I've got a brother in Illinois, but we don't talk. I suppose I could call my parole officer, but I doubt if he'd have any interest in hauling ass down to Texas.